Welcome to DigiBarn Radio, fascinating stories from the history of computing. I'm Tommy Cuellar. Our next piece is entitled Mark Goldstein's Story, 1970s through 2000s. This interview was conducted and recorded by DigiBarn curator Bruce Damer on January 27th, 2006. Let's listen.
So you are Mark?
Mark Goldstein.
Goldstein.
Of Phoenix.
And we're looking at the history of everything from the mid-70s.
Life, the universe, and everything.
Everything.
Which, of course, the answer is 42, and then you're done.
And then you're done.
But, yeah, I was an early employee of MicroAge, also known as the Phoenix Group, who was an initial mover in the distribution of personal computer products.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Howd, a kind of a futurist and visionary, and Jeff McKeever, who actually came out of banking IT,
mm-hmm.
formed the company in probably 74, and I became acquainted with them. And Alan really liked the work I was doing in music, analog music synthesizers and holography, and we became friends. And as MicroAge began to grow, they opened first a byte shop, a second and a third byte shop, and then more of a distribution channel and warehousing. And I was about their 25th employee of a company that eventually became a Fortune 500 company.
So here we see the bike shop in Tempe.
Right.
And
right.
There was one, they were in Mountain View. And
well, they didn't own all of those. They did some of the franchising of them.
Okay.
They eventually owned six themselves, mostly in Texas and Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't own them all. They were a franchiser. You can scan in this stuff if you...
Oh, we probably won't have much time, but
I can
at least...
Or later. So, I worked, as the company grew a little, in an R&D group under a VP, and mostly what I did was evaluate products we might carry, early printers and computer systems.
That's the Soroc terminal.
Soroc terminals we used lots of. That was their favorite terminal, Soroc IQ120s. And everything was mostly S100.
So here we have a North Star Horizon there in the wooden
case. They were big on North Stars, and for a while the processor technology Sols. And others that I've mentioned, that funny little five-slot chassis, Microsystems, I can't quite remember that company's name.
Well, there was Industrial Microsystems.
Yeah.
And then there was, they didn't carry those, and then, of course, there was IMSI.
Right, and later Crememco.
They
were on the scene at the very beginning. And so mostly I evaluated products for us to carry them. I wrote drivers or interfaced them to systems so that they could be used by people.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had that one project, which, again, Alan was a futurist active in the World Future Society nationally.
So that, what was that project?
Well, it was alternately called Albert the Office and Fred the House.
Okay.
So they were meant to be intelligent environments. You'd get up in the morning, be in your house,
Okay. Do
your house automated things, and then go to work. But those two computers would be in contact with each other.
So the,
just pick up where it left off? Or?
Yeah. So the third wave...
Alan Toffler's book from, we believe, 79.
Yeah.
Alan Howd knew Toffler through the World Future Society, and Toffler interviewed him and reported specifically on the project. And it was all done on an Apple II. I think you could only have 48K of memory,
mm-hmm.
but all seven slots were full. There was probably some expanded memory, voice recognition, Mountain Hardware had some cards, voice synthesis, AC remote control, through an X10 interface system.
Right, right.
And I probably have the documentation on exactly what it consisted of. But everything had to be coded in BASIC and assembly language, and it all fit in 48K.
What was it controlling?
So it was controlling lights, printers, thermostats. It was turning on and off.
That's sort of the house
automation.
Microchip house of the future.
And so it really did do, to the extent that voice recognition worked then or even works now, it would load up various vocabularies of speaking or recognition templates depending, because you couldn't hold lots of stuff in your 48K, it would overlay different control groups of speaking patterns.
I recall around 78 watching a TV program about a project somewhere in the Rockies about a microchip house of the future, which had like these smoky dark glass panels people would talk to, and lights would go on and off.
Right.
Do you think this was maybe that was a concept only, or?
This was in my boss's house, but it was never. It was mostly a more of a trade show demonstration, and they would give us our own booth for that. MicroAge would rent a booth, but this project, and there's photos in here.
Okay.
They'd give us a fairly large space where we'd get local furniture and set mm-hmm. up a mm-hmm. kind of part of the display booth would be the office part, and the other part would be the home part, and they would be doing their interactions. And so, as I started to say before, the other not even quite similar thing was at a lot of these shows that it'd be people with little R2-D2 kind of robots,
mm-hmm.
but they'd really be remote controlling them and talking through them, and it was more of a clown thing than it was a real technology thing, because there wasn't.
So this is Albert the Office.
Albert the Office and Fred the House. Here's Alan Howd, or I would hold hourly or 2 hourly.
But it was quite a crowd there.
Yep, and this may have been Philadelphia or Boston or Atlanta, who did more East Coast things.
There's
a television interview.
This is a big trade show somewhere. It's like, this wasn't like PC, you know how they have PC 76.
It wasn't the fairs, no.
It wasn't the
West Coast fairs.
It wasn't the West Coast computer.
I'd been there once, but not with this. And so here I am doing the demos on TV or to an audience. And there were cameras. There were some relay things that could change the views and switch. And so I had rigged up all this software and mm-hmm. hardware as my job, and so that was fun.
The TV and the desk there.
Right, and then we were showcasing a $13,000 desk. It wasn't ours, but MicroAge could get, like a Neiman Marcus catalog. We could get it for you.
Right.
So there was, it was all burl walnut and kind of fancy. But everything was run off the Apple. Though this guy would not limit, I let the interviewers, and there were several TV interviews in different cities, interact with it, and I train mm-hmm. it for their voice. But he insisted on, like, talking in a vernacular, expecting natural language processing.
Right.
Just, in the end, I spent 4 hours reprogramming so I could jerry-rig what actually worked to something that I could hokey up so mm-hmm. that it actually worked the way he wanted to use it. And so it really bugged me because it really worked, and all of a sudden I was doing it for him like the clown computer robots that were running around.
Right, I understood.
So here's a press release from 79 about the time that Toffler covered it and so on. But I did a lot of work in just interfacing products, and in specific, I mentioned what I thought might be a kind of historical point in time,
mm-hmm.
which was the introduction of hard drive subsystems.
Here, can we get a picture of the Office of the Future? Just a point before we go in, what's interesting always to me is... the letter? There we go.
Oh, the press release.
Is what's fascinating to me is that at the same time as you had all this activity in the S-100 and the sort of public space for Office of the Future, you had Xerox with its Altos and its raster screens and distributed documents and whatnot, which really was the Office of the Future, but there was such a disconnect between those two worlds. And this world, the world of the S-100 and what I grew up to become that, at some point, they, of course, borrowed and took all the Xerox stuff and put it on itself. But this is the world that inherited it.
Inherited, absolutely.
So it's just a fascinating. So part of that was, of course, the coming of hard drives.
And we carried the Alpha microsystems that had, small and medium enterprise level applications in mm-hmm. accounting, a lot more solid stuff that you could get. under some other environments, because it was stuff that kind of was downgraded or transferred over from mini computers.
Yeah.
From Data General Novas and DEC minis came to the Alpha Micro.
Yeah.
And so we did introduce, you could buy a hard drive subsystem and for the S100 for $9,995, which was a, you know, a threshold breaking price point to
right.
probably 78, I would say. And so for that $10,000, you got a Konin disk controller, K-O-N-A-N, and they were a Phoenix-based company. I met with them many times
mm-hmm.
when I was working on the driver, and either a CDC Hawk, we called them,
mm-hmm.
Which had 5 meg fixed and 5 meg on a pizza-sized
sure.
removable platter, so
yeah.
you could do your backups. Or you could get a Fujitsu 40 meg fixed drive, and often you wanted both, the CDC Hawk for your operating system and your backup.
In 1978, this would have been the equivalent of buying like 3 new automobiles.
Right.
Type of thing.
But it was just, you picked up these big things, pizza-sized things, with a handle on top, and that whole thing was 5 megabytes, right? Enough
mm-hmm.
for one music file or
today.
A couple of the photos that we're taking
right,
today.
Right.
And
yeah,
so
right.
I had to write the drivers and the hardware documentation and the user documentation, but here's the ad from August of 79 where we it was in some of the major magazines, Interface Age and Byte and other places. Not sure where that
so,
particular
so Jerry Purnell might have had a look at this. And,
right.
Yeah. Because he was started, well, I don't know when he started there, but.
But this was an example of the print ad.
Yeah,
oh, this
yeah.
is from Byte, August 79.
79.
So you'll have the original of the ad. And here's an example of the My Research and Development Tech Notes, how to hook up the CDC drive to an Alpha microcomputer, you know, giving some hardware stuff, some software configuration stuff. And this was sometimes the kind of stuff I did, which was bring computer products together to make
mm-hmm.
some system
yeah.
That then made sense to some
audience.
So you had
to write the drivers. You had to write the
right.
mounting drivers.
Right.
And do it in the right order and
uh-huh.
move it. Mount the table, the file allocation table,
exactly.
and everything.
And I had to write the assembly language, which isn't, I don't, may actually be in some other pages listed here.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. There's a press release as we,
160
megabytes. Is there a year on that? A little later, we got up to 160 megabytes.
Yeah, so this is kind of amazing because it's, you know, before 1980 to have this kind of space.
Right, when we got to the 80s of the PC platform, you could get, I think my first personal hard drive was a Tandon 503, like a 5 meg,
yeah,
five and a quarter full height drive.
Yeah, I've got one in a PC, an original IBM PC.
And they were still expensive, a couple
yeah.
of thousand maybe. You know, maybe they were down to 2,000.
I remember
then.
Getting an AT compatible and then a 10 meg drive, and that was unbelievable.
Graphics. So these were product evaluations. Should we carry this product? What would the audience be?
3D graphics software.
Yeah, so I evaluated software, hardware, helped make the management decisions about what we should carry.
Could barely
worked for a guy, Steve Clough. I thought I actually had the drivers in here. I guess not.
Well, here's a good ad.
Yeah, here's our ad for the Alpha Micro system that gave you 16-bit horsepower 8-bit S100
right.
world.
Right, yeah, because that was definitely, that was the new coming wave, 16-bit.
And Microsoft, MicroAge, correctly anticipated a small business market beyond the hobbyist market and did things like this geared past the hobbyist.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a realistic vision of the personal computers serving a small business to medium business environment.
The strange irony is that IMSI about this time was bankrupt and being
right.
sold off, and yet it was intended to be the small business
right.
And so
but they really weren't.
It was still obvious that we're using them.
But we would slap the Alpha Micros in, slap the hard M-size. Drives. And more often North Stars for some unknown reason. We had an affinity for the North Star.
And MSI seemed to use North Star discs.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's.
Right. And so I had to write the drivers for on the.
And here's your.
Oh, and the music synthesizer, whole different world.
Yeah, she's got a Rhodes Fender 88 as well, which is given to us by a friend, but she sort of grew up with those in the 70s.
But to kind of bring us then to this instead, this is, I had a side business before I went to MicroAge called Advanced Tools for the Arts, and I kept it through the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And as we talked last night, I got my degree in filmmaking. I worked with a cream of independent film movement, but I also knew Nam June Paik and worked on experimental video stuff, mm-hmm. and that's really got my interest started. And you were hacking at that point. You were taking oscillators and driving the yokes of
a TV dance system.
Yeah, I talked to Galen about this last night.
You know her background and with Meyer and Kruger. And
yes, we talked a bit about that. And so I developed.
I'm here.
That's okay.
So you developed
my own line of music synthesizers from scratch. They were kind of the complexity and style of the Mini Moog or the Arc 2600.
Right.
But they had a true patch bay where everything routed to one side and you could use short patch cords in a somewhat coherent user interface. And the other innovation was the first 15 or so connections that you were likely to make were pre-patched to connectors that then disconnected the pre-patch if you plugged into them.
Okay.
And so you could actually power up the analog synthesizer with zero patch cords and have it in which was kind of like a Mini Moog, but you had the flexibility of an ARC 2600 in terms of patching and capability. So it wasn't, it was just another product in that line, but there was a very strong hacking community in electronic music synthesizers in that time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy in Ithaca who knew Moog very well. His name was Bernie Hutchins, though. And I have those somewhere. You may be interested in those. He had an e-music newsletters that, you know, showed he'd develop circuits. Other users would develop analog circuits, and they'd be shared. And it was a whole hacking community, virtual community, around electronic music synthesizers in that analog era in the early 70s. And I have all that stuff yet somewhere. That wasn't garaged, though. I still have that in filing cabinets. You may be interested, perhaps, in that, because it was really analog computers, like John Whitney may have used in an era earlier, right? He did a lot of analog computer work.
Yeah.
So, anyway, Advanced Tools for the Arts. What you were looking at and photographed was work I did with the dance department of the university. Arizona State University bought a couple of my analog music synthesizers in the music and dance department. But the dance department, there was a visionary, David Gregory, there, who was a composer in residence in the dance department. So he wasn't a dancer, but he wanted the dancer's motions to affect the synthesizer and thus the music played.
Okay, okay.
And so I did early analog interpretation devices that would extract artifacts from movement and feed out voltages for the voltage-controlled oscillators and envelope shapers and so on at the synthesizers. But I also built them laser display systems, theatrical light board interfaces, and a whole litany of things that fell under this advanced tools for the arts, kind of thing. So it was a way that I brought my technology forward. This is actually talking about the, well, holography demo. And that's another story. I had a partner, a PhD in optics, and he and I built the second holography lab in the country that could do multiplex or composite motion picture holograms.
Right.
And so the first was a guy who has some renown for having doing it, Loder Lloyd Cross, had a company called Multiplex in the San Francisco area.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually had a much better process. I don't know, these holograms kind of look like lampshades. They're about 10 or 12 inches high, in a circle. There's a famous one of his where a girl's blowing a kiss.
Yes.
That everyone probably has seen. But his had to have three splices because they could only make 120-degree span of the 360-degree. That was just my breadboarding or something.
Sure.
My lab.
Yeah, that's a camera there, not a laser.
Right. So Mirage Holographics in Scottsdale was our joint venture in the late 70s. And we had invented a process by which we could make the hologram in a single pass by moving film through with stepping motors through a big military film vac. Mm-hmm. And what you're really doing is taking a movie frame and stretching it out to a very thin spaghetti strand vertically and making a hologram of the frame.
Okay.
Of one frame. But as you look at the way this is wrapped as a lampshade around a single point light source, a clear bulb, each eye is then seeing a different frame of a movie.
Yes.
So there is a time lag, and if someone moves too fast, there is what we call a time blur. Because you see a hand, let's say, in two positions in space.
Yeah.
But the fact that you either move the camera around the objects and people, or, as we did, put them on a platform and rotate the platform out of view of the frame, each frame of the image had a different angle on the action. And when you presented it in that way, each eye saw a different view and thus a true stereoptical effect.
So this continued while you were at Microage?
Yes. This was a side, I always had side business, side projects. Mm-hmm. So here I am in 1977 in our lab in Scottsdale. Now this took a 4x8, Hexcel is the company. It's steel plates on top of a hex a mesh inside and filled with sand. The tabletop weighed 800 or 900 pounds. And when it was received, we had to go into a bar nearby and empty the bar by offering a round of drinks to everyone or two to come help us move this table into our little rented office in Scottsdale. Mm-hmm. The table top, 4x8 feet, 900 pounds, sat on spare tire inner tubes, small inner tubes that floated in a bath of oil. Those sat on various layers of like plywood and spongy stuff and eventually out to a big steel frame to the ground, but we had to do vibration isolation. This was the control system in Digital Logic that I created to run the pattern of stepping motors on what you'll probably see a view of the optical table and some of the optics. But we had to run shutters and a whole variety of stepping motors, and here we are shooting with a 35 millimeter Arriflex. We shot 35 millimeter film stock, some dancers, and as I told Galen, I have a lifetime affinity for dance and dancers. And let's see if there's anything else. There's a lens that was very hard to make. We made one first ourselves out of plexiglass filled with an optical oil, but we eventually had to have it custom milled and polished, very expensive for us at the time, to get an optically correct lens, kind of anamorphic, that would stretch that 35-millimeter frame as part of the holography.
When I was in graduate school, we had a whole optics lab in our group.
And here's the schematic of how our optics part worked under that control system I built.
You basically made a home-built optical table that would have cost an immense fortune.
Right.
Things were really expensive, I remember.
And this was all done out of personal funds and sweat. But we did have to spend real money on the Hexcel table. Here's a circuit board layout for one of the control boards. And I had to invent my own little stepping motor. There weren't nice single chips that did it. And so I actually did discover, before I learned it by name, I invented Carnot logic.
Okay.
Right? Because I was trying to simplify stepping motor control down to a couple of chips, and the process I eventually got to it by turned out later to have a name that I didn't know at the time. Carnot logic, I think it's called. So Interestingly, to create the hologram, we'd advance everything, wait for all the motor vibrations to settle out,
sure.
And so it would take hours and hours to make a hologram.
Yeah.
Because we'd do a frame, wait about 8 seconds was our cycle time for the next frame, and there were hundreds and hundreds of frames to make it up. And it turned out there was a, not a speed bump, but a kind of bump in the road about 100 yards away. And if a car went over that bump, immediately before the brief exposure to a window in the 8 seconds,
yeah.
It would blur that frame. So we would only run holograms starting about 2 a.m. so that they'd be done before morning rush hour and not too many frames would end up blurred. And that's after all those layers of isolation. 100 yards away, a car going over a bump would blur our frame. So we got some coverage in local press, some good articles. That's someone else that did still frame holography. And I always have had an interest in three-dimensional representation, which is why we should probably talk over breakfast a little more
about
the commons and such.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's another part of my history, which...
We had a tour of Livermore, of the National Ignition Facility, a couple of years ago, because they borrowed the Cray Q2 for an exhibit.
Oh, yeah.
An Edward Teller type exhibit.
Right.
And so we got to go in the NIF, and so the largest... I guess the largest laser system in the world now.
Right. And this was just a helium neon, you know, laser, I don't know, maybe 20 milliwatt, you know, or something, which was at that time a big laser.
Sure.
It was like 4 feet and, you know, eight inches or something square. And again, cost us real money. And we actually did do a proposal for a Disney thing through a subcontractor of theirs to do a kind of Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, kind of display.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, they wanted it life-size. And so our proposal, you could only do 1 foot high. You saw the lens we had to make to do the 1 foot high piece. We had to propose making like a diorama that you rolled on the stage, right, where you'd have a slightly curved surface and you'd pull this 100-foot hologram. But there'd be six of them to get to be 6 feet high.
Sure.
And so we actually did do a proposal that never solidified with Disney through an intermediary to do a amusement park.
Amusement, like a
hologram.
Yeah.
But we always thought that point-of-sale displays in stores were a great market. And embossed holograms, in fact, you know, turned out to be a good and mass-producible product. Ours were so labor-intensive, we thought we could eventually do contact printing of them, but we never got to contact printing. Everyone was a one-off.
So since these years, this is up until the early 80s, presumably,
right.
What have you been up to?
Well, I had an engineering career starting in 1980 after microage. I never had an engineering degree. I had a film degree and experience in experimental video and all this engineering I did in advanced tools for the arts. And at microage, I found I was employable as an engineer. I went to work for Medtronic, a large biomedical device manufacturer, the largest in the world for pacemakers and certain other products. And I ran test engineering for them for 12 years.
Okay.
And so test engineering consisted of what we used to call rack and stack, IEEE 488 GPIB bus equipment. And I didn't bring Medtronic stuff. I had another section in my old notebooks of those. But I ran 45 or 50 engineers and technicians who created, maintained, and wrote software for test systems that moved billions of dollars of heart pacemakers a year. And the line ran, the testers were a precious commodity. They ran the testers, and we had to have tech support 3 shifts a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they had, in our facility, 14 or 15 automatic test equipment stations, but they also had to have them in Minneapolis and Kerkrade, Holland, where we had European final assembly, and in Puerto Rico, where we had U.S. final assembly for tax reasons of various sorts. And so later in my 12 years at Medtronic, I had the opportunity to create a new generation of test systems. And so I did one last great project for them, which I stayed longer probably at that job than I would have liked, but I felt bound ethically and in other ways, affinity-wise, to finish this great project. And that was a new generation tester. It was based, to the extent possible, on VXI boards. There was a, and is, a what is it called? VXI variant of the bus, which is for engineering instruments on a card. And I worked with the early industry association for the VXI bus, which had people like Hewlett-Packard and Wavetech and Tektronix and Dicalrena and some Japanese scope manufacturers and all these people trying to put complex and standalone instrumentation on cards in a VXI bus.
Yeah, yeah.
So we built, and I was the primary architect of the hardware for Medtronic, and had a third of my team in Minneapolis, which meant I did shuttle diplomacy, and they had the comparable software architect guru in Minneapolis, but a third of his staff was on my staff in Tempe. Mm-hmm. So I had a very complex, and then there were people from Holland and Puerto Rico on the team, but a very complex global project in the tens of millions of dollars, and I was the primary hardware architect and team leader for that, and help manage the software because a third of the software team were under my direct reports. So that's my Medtronic era, left in 92. And since then, I had a decision point in 1992, which is what do I want to do on my own? I had always had advanced tools for the arts, then engineering consulting, some product design for others. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, I could be a kind of a product designer for hire, consultant. I could do that, but I've been doing that a while. I could be a computer network guru and hire myself out to, you know, integrate computer applications for businesses, harkening back to some of the things I did for MicroAge in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, there's plenty of computer consultants out there now in 92. I'd just be another one. It doesn't matter that I started in 74, 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
What's so unique about that?
Yeah.
So I had done some patent prior artwork and some product strategic work for people just as part of Advanced Tools for the Arts at times, a product design. I thought I would do research and consulting, and I found a international group, the Association of Independent Information Professionals, AIIP.org, mm-hmm. who is kind of a support group for exactly that, very small businesses who do independent contract research, which they called information brokering, which is a term that one needs to be cautious about. That's a good cartoon there, drawn to accompany and coverage of our project in Newsweek in that era. But so AIIP, which I've been on the national board of that group, and in fact I'm going in the late 90s, sorry, 97 and 99. I'm going back on the board as the national secretary this year for a three-year term. A great support group. So I went out as a researcher and consultant in the technology arena and developed some core expertise in telecommunications, served. My business was probably 70%, 80% telecom-oriented in the late 90s, early 2000. Of course, by 2001, the entire tech market crashed badly, and the worst-hit sector of the downturn in technology was, in fact, telecom, because you had all these companies like Windstar and ART that were overextended, that thought each one of them thought they could own the Metro Wireless or the Metro XYZ marketplace.
Yeah.
And of course, if you added up all the market share that all of them projected, it was about 1,200% of the market if they all got the market share they were basing their business models on.
A friend of ours worked at Global Crossing.
Right, exactly. You know, big overbuilds in fiber and metro wireless solutions and other things. And so since then, since 2001, I've diversified more. Telecom's coming back a little. One of my recent projects, though, I'll talk to you maybe off camera at breakfast, it has been for the Institute for Defense Analysis. And so I've done a lot of work in knowledge management, digital rights management, content aggregation and distribution, mm-hmm. and more recently in knowledge visualization, taxonomy, and ontology, and things like that. I don't know if you want to keep going.
Well, I think we'll
pause a moment.
Stop it or pause it, and thank you very much, Mark.
My pleasure. And I'm so glad maybe we should mention that what I'm here to do is bring you 21 cartons, full cartons of computer magazines,
which finally completes a huge missing part of the Digibar collection, which is the magazines are the most information-rich source.
Right. And I started getting everything, literally, not all the IEEE computer magazines, but everything. And I got some of those, but I didn't archive them. But I received and archived everything from about 74 or 75 through the late 80s, 86 to 88, where this volume of several dozen cartons of stuff and my interest in using them and archiving them kind of diminished, and you're getting the bulk of that collection from the critical 13-year period.
Including the Bytes, which co-founder Alan Lundell, who will be able to see his editorship starting in about 1980.
Right, this complete set of Bytes, except for issue one, which I believe you already have. Yeah. Somehow, I didn't actually get issue one on the newsstand and picked up on it shortly after.
Well, it was a Radio Electronics magazine, and then it got
April
switched.
April 75.
It got September 75 is where it switched to Byte. And in October 75, there's all these confused letters to the editor saying, what happened to our perfectly good Radio Electronics magazine?
Right.
What are these computers doing in here? Carl Helmers.
What, four or five cartons just of Bytes?
Of Bytes.
And so there's many, many years span in very good condition, arguably, of Byte magazines for
you. Stored in a dry garage in Phoenix, Arizona. Tempe or Phoenix,
And so, and as you've seen from the boxes of S100 and Apple stuff, you know, I've pretty well organized that material. And I'm glad to have you mine a bit of it.
Yeah,
so we found the IMSI bankruptcy documents.
The bookends of IMSI, we found the first product literature and then the bankruptcy documents, which is going to go into this year's Little OS's That Could project, because IMSI was the first OEM of CPM. Right. So that goes into the Gary Kildall story.
Right.
So it all fits together. So thank you very much, Mark.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Digibarn Radio. This story is available for some uses under our Creative Commons license. Please check our website at www.digibarn.com. That's www.digibarn.com for this license and more great stuff from the Digibarn collections. This is Tommy Cuellar signing off. Thanks for tuning in.